I'm missing my front crew up here. The youth lectureship was this weekend, so all of our youth are still over there this morning with Tom McGowan, and you guys remember him from the Sing, and it was a fantastic weekend, by the way. It was so good, but they're there this morning, so I'm missing my front crew, so you guys are going to have to be loud as we go through Acts. Acts chapter 1 is about Ascension Apostle. Acts chapter 2 is about Spirit Kingdom. Good. Acts chapter 3 is then about second sermon. And then after that sermon, Peter, John, and the man who they healed are all arrested. So Acts chapter 4 is about, Peter's defense or the first offense. And then you get to chapter 5. And in chapter 5, you're going to have a first and a second of something. You're going to have the first. And who was disciplined? Ananias and Sapphira for lying to the Holy Spirit. And then you're going to have the second defense. And at that point, all 12 apostles are arrested. And who can remember what was so ironic about that arresting and everything that happened there? Say it again. Okay, good. The angel is the one that released them and told them to go preach about the resurrection. And the Sadducees didn't believe in spirits, angels, or the resurrection, and they're the ones who arrested them. So just a great moment of irony there. All right, Acts chapter 6 is about the seven. Acts chapter 7 is about Stephen's death or Stephen's defense, however you memorize it best. Acts chapter 8, who is the primary evangelist in Acts chapter 8? It's Philip. And then you're going to have the first character of note in Acts chapter 8 is Simon the sorcerer. That's right. And then the second one is the Ethiopian eunuch. Good. Acts chapter 9, we're introduced to the primary historical character for the rest of the book of Acts, and that's about, Saul's conversion, or Paul. Acts chapter 10, a duplicate of Acts chapter 2, but not with the Jews. So Acts chapter 10 is about Gentile Spirit Kingdom. You guys are like, that's your favorite chapter. Everyone's got that one. Acts chapter 11, Peter's going to come back to Jerusalem and he's going to bring a report of what's happened. News has gotten back to Jerusalem. And then there's a primary Gentile church that's established in what city? Antioch, that's right. Then we have Acts chapter 12, and we're going to have another first. That's right. It's going to be the first apostolic martyr, and who dies? James. Who beheads him? Herod. That's right, the tetrarch. And then he arrests Peter, but Peter is going to escape again by the hand of an angel. Then we get to Acts chapter 13. We have the beginning of something grand in Acts chapter 13. What begins? First missionary journey. And then, of course, naturally then Acts chapter 14 is going to be the conclusion of that journey. Good. Then Acts 15. There have been some Judaizing teachers that are messing with what Paul and Barnabas and others have been teaching. And what were they saying the Gentiles had to do? Keep the law and be circumcised. And then they go down to Jerusalem and you have the Jerusalem conference. And then they come to a determination, and there's four things that the Gentiles must do. It's not keep the law and be circumcised, but they not anything related to idols, to sexual immorality, to abstain from things strangled, and from blood. And so those are the only four requirements, and they sent that out via letter. End of Acts 15, beginning of Acts 16, we have a disagreement between which two people? Paul and Barnabas. And those were the, we didn't do that. They were the first two evangelists to go on the first journey together. And who did they bring with them? John Mark. But because he left early, this is why we have that departure now and that division now. There was a disagreement between them. So Paul is going to start the second missionary journey in Acts 16. And who is he going to bring with him? It's not Barnabas. Silas, that's right. And so we start here. I should turn this on. We start here, and they're going to go up here. We're going to go up into Lystra and Iconium. And who are we going to pick up in Iconium? What young man? Timothy, that's right. He's from Iconium. and from Lystra, and then we're going to come up here into Antioch, into Ephesus, and in Troas we meet the writer of this book. And who do we pick up in Troas then? Luke, that's right, the physician. We come across, and then we get into Acts 17, and it's going to focus on three churches primarily. Acts 16 focused on Philippi, but then Acts 17, you're going to have three primary churches. It's Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. That's right. And Luke is going to stay in Philippi. Which one of Paul's companions stays back in Thessalonica, by the way? Timothy. So we know Paul's alone in Athens, so where does that likely leave Silas? In Berea, that's right. Then we got to Acts 18, Paul leaves Athens, he goes to Corinth, and then he's going to return to Jerusalem. So Acts 18 is a combination. It's the end of the second missionary journey, and then also the beginning of the third. Acts 19 is all about what city? Ephesus, because Paul had gone through at the end of his second journey and then promised that he was going to come back. Let's jump right into it then. It's at this point that Paul writes 1 Corinthians. We talked about that last time. But we're going to get into what's going on in the city, because up to this point, Paul has had incredible success amongst the Gentiles in this city. What amazing event happened last time before this disruption is going to happen in Ephesus? Remember, there were these seven sons of Sceva, and they were trying to cast out the demon, and then they fled through the streets, and it became known to everyone. So what did the believers start to do? They came together, and they did something. They burned a bunch of stuff. Okay.
Because the demon recognized Paul.
Good, good. Very good point.
Paul had never had any direct connection with this demon before or anything like that, but his actions here in this world
impacted the spiritual one. That's right. That's right. So up until this point, though, Paul has had tremendous success, and that's what he wrote to Corinth, is because of the great door of opportunity that he writes here to them. Let's see here. That he intends to stay in Ephesus, for a wide door of effective work has opened me. They'd come together, they burned their books. It amounted to 50,000 pieces of silver. One piece of silver was a day's wage, 137 years worth of salary. If you're going to make that equivalent today, that's like if you take $60,000 as an average salary, that's $12,500,000 that they came together and burned. Yeah?
For the price of silver today, that's $740,000.
For 50,000 pieces? Okay. So just incredible amount, whatever way you want to put it together, an incredible amount of money that they were able to just burn for the sake of knowing and gaining Christ Jesus. But it is not going to stay that way, because there's also going to be many adversaries. And this is what you need to remember for the rest of the book of Acts. The love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And that is going to be the key to the rest of the persecution that's going to happen for Paul on the third missionary journey. So let's read the text. It says, "About that time there arose no little disturbance concerning the way." Now that was the name of the movement of the church at that time, likely out of John 14:6, the teachings of that. They didn't have that written yet, but when Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me." But it says, "There's a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis that brought no little business to the craftsmen there." All right. This is another one of those moments where archaeology helps us to confirm what the scriptures say during that time, which is amazing. And Luke Chandler actually talked about this very thing when he was here with us. And it's going to help us to understand, one, which God this is talking about, and then two, what we've dug up. These shrines that they would have been making, what they would have been was a small figure of the god or goddess within the temple. And then these silver shrine makers and other types of shrine makers, they would make them out of wood or out of marble. They would then sell them, and people would buy them and either use them as like a good luck charm. You know how like the Catholics will wear like the Saint Christopher, and it's supposed to keep them from harm, and they'll rub it, different things like that, very superstitious. The same thing that they did. They would wear a shrine or something like this on an amulet, or they would take it home and set it up, and it would be a household god. Remember way back in the Old Testament with Laban and his daughter Rachel, and she had taken the household gods with her and hid them. This was a long-standing practice in the ancient world. You would have a little god, so to speak, in your house for your own private worship. Now, let's just think about this. If books were worth that kind of money, 50,000 pieces of silver, how much money do you think these men were getting from selling these shrines that people felt religiously obligated to have that were made of pure silver? I mean, the text, Luke always doesn't, you know, he does a great job of being very ambiguous just to, you know, give us a hard time. He says, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These guys were filthy rich when you look historically at what they did. So much so, this is how much the silver was worth. When we dig, we actually find no silver shrines whatsoever. Now, one person might look at that and say, well, therefore, Luke was wrong. You know, he was not a silversmith because all we find is clay and marble shrines. Why wouldn't you find silver shrines archaeologically? That's right. Anyone at some point when they're conquered, they're going to take all the silver and they're going to melt it down and use it for currency or use it for their own society. Remember, that's what Israel did when they were going to make the golden calf. They took all the jewelry from the Egyptians and they melted it down. This is what the reason that we don't find any silver shrines. They were of such value that you would take it and you would go through the process of melting it down because of what you would get out of it. So these men were filthy rich. But what, it says Artemis or Diana. Now, normally, what would go off in your mind is the Greek goddess, Diana or Artemis. That is not the same goddess as the one that is worshipped here at the temple in Ephesus. And I did not know that. The Waldrons and Reese both talk about this. Though Diana was called Artemis among the Greeks, she was not the same as the Greek goddess Artemis, who was the queen, huntress, chaste, and fair. This Diana was the local manifestation of the great mother of gods and men who had become worshipped in Asia Minor from ancient times. This is what's going to correlate it right here to what Luke Chandler talked about. Artemis of the Ephesians was a very different goddess. The same as Cybele, the mother goddess, the nurse of all, a fertility goddess. A statue of the goddess represents her as a many-breasted female figure. I don't have a picture for you. You're welcome. With arms extended in a gesture of welcome or invitation. And the worship was orgiastic, accompanied by frenzied dancing and ceremonial prostitution, and other abominations, among which often was human sacrifice. All right, do you remember Luke Chandler talking about the Ashtaroth? That's the same goddess that was worshipped 2,000 years earlier in Canaan, and this is the same goddess that was worshipped here in Ephesus. It was a fertility goddess. And as Reese notes here, you know, Aphrodite was the goddess of fertility and love and those types of things. How did they worship Aphrodite? Yeah, through whoring and through prostitution. This is what Ephesus was also known for, was how you worship the fertility goddess was through temple prostitution. You would do your civic duty to go to the temple and lay with a prostitute and then go home, and that was your service of worship. All sorts of other things that took place within the city. But you're starting to get an understanding of the kind of empire that Ephesus had on idolatry. Everyone came to this temple. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Everyone came to this temple to worship this goddess. And so you would come and, you know, just speaking from a worldly perspective, is that kind of worship attractive for people to travel and then worship the goddesses, to go and lay with a temple prostitute? To the world, is that attractive?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what a difficult job. And then you leave, and everyone there in Ephesus is involved in these different trades and businesses. As people come through, they have a monopoly on this business, and so they're able to charge whatever they want for people to buy these shrines and different things. So, for example, like when there's an event that happens like in Salem or in some city, like with the Olympics, you notice, what does everyone do with their prices when everyone's migrating to that area? Yeah, amazingly, gas goes up 50 cents a gallon, you know, and all these different things happen. Well, this is going to have an amazing commentary on Paul's preaching. Because what we're going to see is Paul was having such an impact in the city of Ephesus and the surrounding areas of Asia with the gospel that it was hurting their business enough to where they thought they might go out of business. Now, let's just put that into perspective today. What would happen if all of a sudden all the adult shops in Salem were up in arms because they were afraid of going out of business because the preaching that was taking place here at South Salem and impacting the community? Do you understand what's happening here? There is a huge movement in Ephesus towards the way. There are hundreds and hundreds of people coming to the gospel. And they recognize, because of Paul's preaching, we go back to Athens, Paul said that there are no gods made with human hands. That God cannot be fashioned like man fashions a god. And so as people obey the gospel, not only are they going to stop visiting the temple, but they're also going to stop purchasing these silver shrines. And so this silversmith is seeing his demise, and he decides, I've got to do something about it right now. So he's going to pull together everyone from similar trades. That could have been marble, you know, shrine makers. It could have been clay shrine makers, all these different guys. But anyone involved in the idol industry, the idol business, he's going to try to get riled up. Yeah, Brad. Okay.
And the United States, you know, no deal illegal to produce alcohol. What happened?
Mm-hmm. The back market.
The backlash, the violence, mm-hmm. the everything that came out of that, as those people defended their ways of life and, mm-hmm. and so forth.
And same thing's going to happen here. And so he's going to try to persuade them against Paul. And here's his argument. He starts out, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. He's getting together all the fat cats of Ephesus that run everything, and he's saying, guys, if you like your position, if you like your wealth and your standing, then you have got to do something because you are about to lose it all. And he goes on to say, you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. Remember what it had said at the middle of the last chapter, or this last chapter, is that from the school of Tyrannus where he was teaching, all of Asia heard the word. And we're going to go through, and when we look at different epistles, You know, Paul, when he writes Colossians, guess who he had never visited once before? He had never met the saints in Colossae. How did they get started? Well, we know it was from another guy named Epaphras. Then where did he learn what he knew? Well, probably from Ephesus. And then he took it with him and started the church in Colossae. And that's how Paul knew about it. But all of Asia was hearing the word. And so Demetrius is understanding it's not just going to affect our regulars and our business here, but it's going to affect people that normally would come and migrate to worship at the temple here and buy shrines. They're no longer going to do that. So he sees not just local collapse, but through the entire country, they are going to have a serious problem if the gospel continues to be preached. And that's exactly what's going to happen, because as Christianity grows and grows, these temples are eventually just going to be completely laid desolate after a few hundred years, where no one is honoring these gods anymore. Saying that gods made with hands are not gods, which is amazing, because what was their whole profession? Dave. Yeah, yeah.
And it resembled something, and from that, they then devised this god, this multi-breasted woman, whatever, and that became their god. And so the silver shrines, these are things that they made with hands, but they said that it fell from heaven, and this is their god. And, you know, it's not unlike what people do today. You see rocks that are in shapes of art, people collect them. They collect everything, leaves, etc. You collect all kinds of stuff. But again, these are simply part of God's creation, and they're worshiping the creature rather than the creator.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, Dad.
Just a comment. This has also been a problem even in with God's people back in Hosea. Even the priests at that time, Hosea 4, were profiting from the people's sin. And in fact, it says they set their heart on their iniquity, like people, like priests. The priests were actually getting rich from they were in this business of sin, and they were getting rich from that. People then coming to them to buy sacrifices and, you know, doves and things like that. And so it's a profitable business.
Very similar to the indulgences historically when you look at the Catholic Church in medieval times. All right, so that's a problem for them. And there's a danger that not only this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and she even may be deposed from her magnificence, all whom Asia and the world worship. He says, this is bigger than just us. Not only are we going to go broke, but no one's going to worship Artemis anymore. And this great grand temple, one of the seven wonders of the world, one day someone's just going to come through because no one worships her, and they're just going to get rid of it. They're gonna do what they did to the temple of the Lord when they destroyed Jerusalem. Everything in that temple that was so grand and so wonderful, all the gold, guess what they did with it? Melted it down. Took it back to Babylon, right? And so that is going to happen. He's a smart man. Eventually, this is exactly what's going to happen to this temple. But this is going to be the reaction of the people. I'm just going to just take this for what it's worth. People in and of themselves can be kind of dumb. You know, people can be dumb, but groups of people can be really dumb. You know, that's just the truth. When people get all riled up, just case in point, there'll be times when we were at Florida College, we'd have chapel, and everything's really reverent and somber during chapel time, but then we'd have announcements afterwards, and someone would just start chanting something, and then everyone else would join in. They would have no idea what they're talking about, but someone would just start chanting USA, USA, and then all of a sudden you have 500 student bodies chanting USA for 5 minutes for no reason. Why are we chanting USA? I had no idea, but everyone else was doing it, so that's what I'm doing. Crowds are dumb. And it just is what it is. You can see it at any other event. So when these guys hear this, they're enraged, and they're going to start crying out, "Great is Artemis of Ephesus!" And they're just walking, yelling through the city, and they're marching together, and they're yelling this out like a prayer or like a chant to get the people worked up. And so if you are from Ephesus and you realize these are the important, prominent people of the city, and you poke your head out the window, and these guys are all marching together and yelling, "Great is Artemis of Ephesus," what are you going to do? You're going to jump in and follow them, right? What's going on? And so as they're marching through the city towards the theater, which would have been the second greatest wonder of the city, it seated 25,000 people. It says the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. So everyone's coming together, but no one knows why they're coming together. Normally, the theater was the place where they would have town meetings. The ecclesia is actually the word there, an assembly. And it was supposed to be organized and structured. And so half these people probably thought, well, I didn't know we were supposed to have a town meeting. So they jump right in there and they're going towards the theater. But everyone gets there and some people are like, why are we here? No one knows. They're just all there chanting, "Great is Artemis of Ephesus." But on their way, the silversmiths, they don't find Paul, but they find two men that we are told are Gaius and Aristarchus. There are four different Gaiuses in the New Testament. This is not any one of those, because it says he's a Macedonian. But Aristarchus, this is going to be the same individual that's going to accompany Paul to Rome. He's going to stick with Paul from now on till the end of the book of Acts. But they drag them along, and likely persecution is involved there. And then verse 30, this is amazing. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were his friends, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now, these individuals are some of the most important people in that province. They were elected by Rome to govern the games and the different events and social things, and so they would put these things on. And we aren't told they're Christians here, but somehow Paul has a relationship with them. Now, why would Paul, one, want to go into this theater that's all chanting, "Great is Artemis of Ephesus"? And then, two, why would everyone, the disciples and his friends, the rulers of the city, want to keep Paul from actually doing that?
Crowd's out of control.
Okay. Okay. You guys, I'll take it in just a second. You guys remember, just think back in the news. When there's a protest or a riot and a big mob of people are together, what kind of things do people do that you would normally never see those kind of people doing if they were just going about their daily business? I mean, looting, people that have never stolen in their life will be breaking windows and grabbing stuff, flipping cars, burning things. You're just like, are these actually people? And that's how mobs act sometimes. And so they do not want Paul to go in there because they know if Paul goes in there, what's going to happen to Paul? He's going to die.
I was going to say, Paul is a lightning rod of this thing. It would be much like if you took one of the policemen who was involved in a shooting when the mobs erupted. If you had brought that policeman out.
And put him out in everybody.
And kill him.
Yeah.
And this crowd's out of control, and Paul is a lightning rod.
Okay. But Paul wants to go because Paul, one, it implies that these folks are actually being beaten when it says dragged them. Is Paul the kind of guy that's willing to stand there and watch others be persecuted while he stands by the side in safety? I mean, Paul's always willing to put his body on the line. He's not going to let his friends suffer by themselves. The only reason Paul does not go up there is for the sake of all the other disciples that are saying, "You cannot go." Now, later, Paul's going to refuse the disciples, and he's going to go somewhere where he knows he's going to be persecuted, but we're going to get there in just a little bit. But the other reason is, every time Paul has tried to address a crazy crowd, he sees an opportunity to preach the gospel. Paul is an equal opportunity abuser. It does not matter who the crowd is or what's going on, he's going to find an opportunity to preach the gospel. And so that can be Paul's motivation here, too. Yeah, Brad.
It's much easier to turn passion, to direct passion in the right direction than to try to start up something that is not passionate. teach math, if I got someone arguing that they have the right answer when I know they're wrong, I don't mind them arguing with me because eventually I know I will get them in the right direction towards the correct answer. Because as long as they're arguing, they're passionate about it, they're thinking about the things, they're and trying to defend, they look at your arguments and try to counteract them, which then you know won't happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's interest, there's zeal for it. I mean, Paul himself was one of those.
Mm-hmm. Good, very good. And so, this is an interesting thing that we're told here, though. It says, now some cried out one thing and some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. So, some of them are saying, I know why we're here. We're here because of Paul. And other people are like, no, we're here for a town meeting. And then you can just picture, like, you know how rumors start? Someone's probably there because, no, the proconsul's coming to town. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? And just everyone is in confusion. They have no idea what's going on. Real quick, Dave.
Mm-hmm. Pays more like a compliment, but to this one here, to the unknown God, him I will proclaim to you more clearly. So there again, Paul was very careful, and so they couldn't really hold anything. He was just preaching Jesus Christ and doing that, and he was careful on how he did it so that he would not offend them personally.
That's right.
And what they believed.
That's right. We're going to see that from this point, it doesn't matter how Paul would have addressed them. It's good that Paul stayed because Paul would not have been given an audience. And here's why. A Jew tries to get up to address the crowd. It says, now the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander motioned with his hand, wanting to make a defense to the crowd. Some have tried to say that this is the same Alexander the coppersmith that did much harm to Paul. No evidence for that, just speculation. So we don't know that for certain. But why, this is interesting, why would he want to make a defense? This has nothing to do with the Jews, so why would he be wanting to make a defense?
They're concerned, anyone in that town, that the leader is going to be concerned that the Romans are going to look on them and take away their freedom.
Okay, now we're getting to the point here. This is a political move by the Jews, is what it is. Because they recognize Paul is their target. And do the Romans view the Jews and the Christians as a different sect at this point? Not really. They kind of see them as the same thing. So what do the Jews want to make sure they do in regards to their relationship to Paul?
Separate
themselves. Now, they're going to recognize he's a Jew, and the law taught what about idols also? Yeah, that there is no such thing as an idol, and to turn away from idols. So they're not going to give him an audience just because he's a Jew, and they know what he might say. But it appears when it says make a defense, his entire point was to say, listen, we've lived in harmony with you. We don't have any problems with you. The problem is Paul. And the problem is his preaching the gospel. It's the whole mentality, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know? And so here, that's basically what he's going to try to get up to say, is we have a common enemy in Paul, so we're good. We're friends. Don't start thinking and dragging us into this like we have something to do with it. But again, they recognize he's a Jew. And here we go, crowd mentality. For 2 hours, they all cry out with one voice, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. All right, so we're going to practice. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to all chant that for the rest of the class for 10 minutes. Would you guys get tired by 5 minutes? These guys were pumped up, okay? And I'm holding hands because we've got to get through this. What happened there? Wait a second. Oh, no. This is unacceptable. Okay. Someone didn't put the last slide up there. Like, actually didn't make it. So, end of Acts 19. Here we go. Verse 35. I did not put it on the slide. That's fantastic. Verse 35. Now, it says, when the town clerk had quieted the crowd. All right. Now, that does not sound like someone very important when it's translated that way, the town clerk. I mean, that kind of sounds like, you know, like Farmer John or, you know, the local, you know, pharmacist or whatever. The bookkeeper showed up. That is not who this guy is. This was the most important man in the entire city. And he was second only to the proconsul who was set over that region. The same word used for this individual is the same word used for a scribe in the Old Testament. And what this man's job was all the city records were approved by him. All of the city, everything revolving the city, he kept safe. All of the financial decisions for the city went through him. I mean, he was like the mayor or the governor, so to speak. He was the most important person in Ephesus. So he's going to get up, and he is not going to care a single bit about anything that these men are upset about, because he recognizes that what has just happened has just put everyone in that city in serious jeopardy. Let's look at that. Look at verse 35. It says, "Men of Ephesus, who is there that does not know that the city of the Ephesians is the temple keeper of the great Artemis, of the sacred stone that fell from the sky?" David alluded to that earlier. Here's his point. He says, all right, you're getting all upset that people are going to forget about Artemis. He says, guys, get it together. Everyone knows how great Artemis is. The entire world knows how fantastic this goddess is and comes to visit her. And this is one of the greatest wonders of the world. We are one of the greatest cities and empires here. And so he's trying to appeal to basically tell them, you're blowing things out of proportion. This, you are getting all worked up over something that is not going to have an effect on the big picture. That's his first point. Then he's going to go on to say, seeing that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. Because often mobs are loud and do rash things. Verse 37. For you have brought these men here, this would have been Gaius and Aristarchus, who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. Now, that word sacrilegious, the actual literal translation is robbers of temples, is what that means. And so what his appeal here is these men have not done anything as far as civil law is concerned, worthy of punishment, nor of religious law, blasphemers. When Paul preached, and David made this point earlier, was Paul very careful how he preached when he spoke about the religions of the other world? And he would say, I see you're very religious, but you need to understand there are no gods made with hands. He did not get up and start speaking evil and use harsh and inappropriate language regarding these goddesses or these gods. And so Paul was very tactful with how he spoke. And so this town clerk is aware of this movement. He says they aren't doing anything that is civilly worthy of punishment, and they are not doing anything that is by Roman law, you know, preaching a new religion or anything like that, worthy of punishment. So if therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Every day there was a system of courts by the gate where you can bring civil matters before the judges. And if you did not like the conclusion that the judges came to at the gate, then you could appeal to the proconsul, who would see people on a regular basis and go over these kinds of issues. His whole point here is, if you have a legitimate problem, a legal problem with these men, we already have a system to work this out. It's not chanting your head off and going to the theater and beating these men publicly. If you've got a problem with them, you take them to court. And if you don't like what happens in court, then you go to the proconsul. And then he says something interesting in verse 39. If you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. We have, since I don't have it up there, a record of, in this city especially, with this theater, there was a town meeting. I want to see if I can find it especially. There's a town meeting that would happen every, I keep going back to the screen like it's up there, every week or once a month. It depended on each city. And you would come together and you would vote on different issues, and you would bring issues that regarded the whole city up at that point. So here's his point. You've got the whole city up in an uproar, and if he is committing a crime against the entire city in all of Asia, as you so say he is, it's not just a personal matter that you can solve in the courts, then this is the area to bring it up when we come together in an orderly fashion for this assembly. Number three? Hey, look at that. It is there. Such an assembly was a common practice 3 different days each month. So it was 3 times a month. And in such assemblies, issues could be voted upon and discussed in an orderly fashion. But was this assembly an orderly fashion?
No.
All right, now we're out of time. Here's the point that he's going to make. Verse 40. For we are really in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. And note, this crowd that had been chanting for 2 hours, it says, when he said these things, he dismissed the assembly. They could just leave. Why? Well, under Roman law, he makes this final plea. And by Roman law, rioting was first of all punishable by death. So Rome could have had the opportunity to come in there, come into the theater, and what would they have started to do to get this mob to settle down? They would have just started going through on horseback and killing people. They would have just marched in and started spilling blood everywhere. So that's problem number one. But number two, they can also have severe consequences on the city, where the city would have been revoked all of its Roman citizenship for rioting, and they would have taken back its authority to host one of the Roman goddesses. They would have bankrupted the entire city. Everyone loses their citizenship. They lose the temple. They would have lost everything for rioting. That's just Roman law. So they realize Demetrius is up in arms because he might be losing some money. The town clerk gets up and says, you guys realize what you've done? You've now jeopardized everyone, not just money, but their citizenship and the standing of this city. And so when they all hear that, what do they all do? We're done. We're going to go home. And speaking of that, we got to be done. We're out of time.